Hi, this is Katie, and
This is EU.
welcome to our podcast that is not yet named. We're going to be answering bedside nurses' questions and going from there. Yeah?
Yeah, sounds good.
Okay.
We're also experiencing some technical difficulties. We're sharing one microphone right now, so that's good. It's good.
Yeah.
So if you have issues about the, if there are issues about audio quality after the fact, yeah, you can blame me.
All right, cool. Should we just go and get into it? All right, so the first question that was submitted was, what is PEEP?
What is PEEP? Okay, so what is PEEP? So obviously you've seen it in the context of probably of two devices. One is people on mechanical ventilation, and
Yeah.
then the other is in the context of like CPAP or non-invasive positive pressure. In both cases, right, it stands for positive end expiratory pressure.
Okay.
And it's associated with delivery of positive pressure, right? And recognize that that's different from what is physiologic, which
Okay.
when we are walking around breathing, we are experiencing negative pressure ventilation,
Okay.
right? You know, you suck your diaphragm down, you suck air into your body, right? That's normal.
Right.
And when we have somebody who's intubated or on CPAP or BiPAP, the opposite is true. We're forcing air into their lungs, right? We're
Okay.
like pushing it in. So that's just to begin with. I just want to point out that that's non-physiologic, totally abnormal for humans. When you make that transition from negative pressure to positive pressure, one of the problems that can occur or that you can incur is atelectatic lung tissue, meaning a lot of the lungs, a lot of the alveoli in the lung will start to collapse.
When you switch from
Negative to
negative to
positive.
positive.
And in fact, even in negative pressure, people become atelectatic. And when you monitor a normal, healthy person's breathing, it isn't a consistent tidal volume. Actually, our tidal volumes are all over the place throughout the day, even at rest. So we're doing all this like sighing and big breath, small breath. We don't even realize it. And the reason is because we want to try and keep our lungs expanded. Our patients in the ICU are at a higher than average risk of atelectasis because they really can't move for themselves and they can't take these big sighs for themselves. So as a consequence, they're laying on their back the whole time. and so all the lung tissue in the back of the thorax kind of gets squashed. To try and prevent or reduce that, we introduce PEEP, right? So positive end expiratory pressure. And what it is a constant airway pressure that is maintained even when the patient breathes all the way out, right? So at the end of every breath, when they've exhaled completely, there's still a little bit of pressure there. And the idea is just to try and stent open some of that lung tissue so it doesn't all collapse. It's also a really safe way to deliver airway pressure in general, compared to having a bigger breath, which is quite injurious for the lungs. Or breathing really fast or whatever, which often you don't need, we increase the PEEP to try and increase the total pressure being delivered in the through the lungs. And the total pressure again helps to keep the lungs open and as a consequence usually helps your oxygenation, right? So for patients where their oxygenation is compromised, you can try to fix it by increasing the FiO2, the percent is inspired oxygen. Or you can try to improve it or fix it by just getting as much lung tissue involved as possible. And one way of doing that is to increase the airway pressure, increase the PEEP. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I guess like my other questions for that, like why, as bedside nurses, like when should we look for that? When should we be like, hey, maybe this person needs a little bit more PEEP versus FiO2? Would that ever be a call we would, a question we would ask or a call we would make or?
Yeah. You know, I think that the answer is yes. There are a lot of other physiologic consequences of changing the PEEP. So, in heart failure patients, when you change the PEEP, you're changing the preloading conditions, right? When the PEEP is very high, you can think of the venous, you can think of PEEP as kind of a barrier to venous return. So, when the PEEP is really high, it kind of sequesters some of the blood away from the heart, like, you know, in your IVC or whatever. So when you change the PEEP, you fundamentally can sometimes change the loading conditions of the heart. So probably not advisable for you to be changing the PEEP on your own. But the times when I would think about PEEP are people who are hypoxic, People who you know for whatever reason, whether it's coming back from CT scan or you know, their chest x-ray, you see a lot of atelectasis, small lung volumes while being intubated. And then lastly, it's quite often very beneficial for people in heart failure, depending on the etiology. But a lot of times people in heart failure respond very well to PEEP. So those are the patients for whom some PEEP or an increase in PEEP can be quite beneficial.
Okay. So. And then my last question is, so like a recruitment maneuver, can you just kind of explain that and why we use it?
So a recruitment maneuver is kind of like an artificial side. Right.
Okay.
When you are, if you like, you can imagine you like been laying in bed or whatever for all day, you're like reading a book, you get up, you do a big stretch, you do a big yawn or a big sigh. And that is your body's way of trying to open up all that alveolar tissue that has been collapsed because you were laying down. Because our patients who are mechanically ventilated can't really do that easily, what we end up doing instead is we do it for them. Right.
Okay.
And so a recruitment maneuver is just a really, really unsustainably high PEEP for an extended period of time. And so it might be 20 or 30, which is a really, really high PEEP and really just in general high airway pressures for maybe like 20 seconds.
Okay.
Right. And we do it to try and pop open those stuck alveoli that are kind of stuck shut and collapsed in themselves. That's it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Again, because of the effect of any kind of intrathoracic pressure on venous return, on preload, you have to be a little careful when you do it. I'm sure you've seen some patients when you do an aggressive recruitment maneuver, they get hypotensive because you really are reducing their venous return, reducing their stroke volume, reducing their cardiac output. So you can't do it for very long.
Just like, here you go. Okay, cool.
Is that helpful?
That is actually very helpful, yeah.
Okay, good.
All right. Sweet.
All right, good.
I don't think we have anything else we need to add to that one. All right, so question number two that was submitted was, what are the implications of valve dysfunction post-surgery? This is kind of a super broad question. I don't really know where they're going with this, but.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a very broad question. Oftentimes, if you have residual valvular dysfunction post-surgery, it means that it was not significant enough that it had to be repaired, right?
Okay, so it was there previously. Like, it was there, like prior to doing surgery. They did surgery on, like, one of the other valves, but they didn't feel this valve needed it. Okay.
So that's one possibility. And the other possibility is that there's, you know, a paravalvular leak or something around the new valve.
Okay.
That also sometimes can happen.
All right.
I guess it depends a lot on the specific context. Most of the time, if they got out of the OR with a small leak or a residual, you know, preoperative leak, what it means is that it's probably not that clinically relevant most of the time, right? I mean, not always. Every once in a while, the patient will develop a paravalvular leak or the valve will fail and they'll need a reoperation. But 9 times out of 10, it's not something I worry about very much, because if it were physiologically that relevant, they probably would have repaired or replaced the valve.
Can you just quickly explain paravalvular leak for the audience for me?
No problem. So when I say paravalvular leak, what I mean is that, well, let's say somebody had bad aortic stenosis and they needed their aortic valve replaced.
Okay.
Right? And so then you replace it, right?
Right.
After you replace this aortic valve, or like think about what you've replaced it with, right? It's a bioprosthetic, or these days less and less likely, but a mechanical valve. This valve, in order to work, has to sit where the old valve was, and the old valve gets excised or whatever, right?
Okay.
But the valves come from the manufacturer in like a set size, right? Like,
oh, okay.
Yeah, there are multiple sizes, but you get one, right?
Okay, yeah.
And so it's not like 100% tailor-made to the patient's anatomy often. So what sometimes can happen is that because the valve doesn't fit perfectly,
right,
there's a leak around the new bioprosthetic valve.
Okay.
And so that is a paravalvular leak.
Oh, okay.
Right. So like around the valve leak, right?
What clinical signs like would you look for with any sort of valve dysfunction post-op?
You know, I think most of the time, like I said, it's not going to be that clinically relevant. And so as a consequence, the signs that you might pick up are minimal. Most of the time, you're going to be able to get it on imaging. So based on the TEE during the case or like a TTE afterwards, you might see something.
Okay.
The other thing is that sometimes when patients are grossly fluid overloaded, there may be something like nothing wrong with their valves.
Right.
And they could still develop regurgitant flow because the ventricle can be so dilated that the valve now is not meeting.
Okay. So they just have too much going on. They're just too much on board. So now the valve just can't, it like just can't come together.
That's right.
It needs to. So everything's backing up. Anyway.
So every once in a while you do see that where the ventricles are so overloaded,
right?
They're just very dilated. So then your valves, which normally in order to work, they have to meet, right? And they have to close. They can't do that anymore. They can't touch.
Okay.
Right. Because the ventricle is expanded. So.
Right.
In those patients, classically, if you have a central line in, you'll see these, very elevated CVP tracings.
Okay.
But these CVP tracings that look almost like A-line tracings, meaning not flat, but like with a rhythmic up and down.
Like an actual huge waveform. Okay.
Huh. Yeah. And so sometimes you'll see that on that, or if you have a swan in similarly, right? But it's pretty uncommon, and most of the time it'll be obvious that person needs fluid off in other ways, like they'll be just grossly overloaded. Oh. So, you know, I wouldn't fixate too much on it, and I wouldn't fixate too much on the on post-operative valvular dysfunction.
Yeah.
Because most of the time it's not that clinically relevant.
Right. It would be some. Okay. That makes sense.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. So the next question is indications for weaning pressors. This question is kind of lengthy, so there's multiple kind of questions within this question, but why would you start with Levo instead of Vaso? And when would you add additional support? And what type of additional support do you typically like to add? I guess it doesn't say that, but that's how I interpreted that question.
Okay, so obviously that's a big topic. And I think, you know, to really adequately cover the management of like how we choose to manage our pressors and inotropes is, it could be like its own lecture, more than that maybe. I will say this though. Usually what we're trying to do, right, is we're trying to give between our pressors, like, you know, norepi, vaso, phenylephrine, and our inotropes, right? So like epi, milrinone, dobutamine, right? The idea is to try and get the patient's hemodynamics to a level that we would consider to be pretty normal, right? We want to really what we're trying to do is trying to approximate what we think normal physiologic cardiac output for that person should look like.
Okay, so basically you're just trying to match like you said, what their normal output would look like. So you're trying to use the least amount of pressor, the least invasive pressor, and then mimic, okay.
Yeah. No, that's exactly right. Okay. And so the way we look at it is, you can look at it a number of different ways, right? So I think the most... On a very kind of basic level, you could say, how do this patient's extremities feel, and are they making urine? Okay. Because those are like very broad clinical indicators of good cardiac perfusion, right?
Okay.
And when I say that, I mean that their cardiac output is adequate, and also their MAP is adequate, because you really need both for your tissues to be adequately perfused in the long term.
Right.
Okay. And if they're not doing those two things, then you have to change something, right? Otherwise the patient is headed towards renal failure, multi-system organ failure, possibly death, right? No. not ideal.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're trying to avoid that. taking that like one step, I don't want to say up, but maybe a little bit more complex, you could look at, for example, a CVP, you can look at an A-line,
right.
You can look at a PA catheter, or you could look at a mixed venous gas.
Okay.
And with all of these, you know, monitoring devices, they all have their advantages and disadvantages. But the whole point of the exercise is to try and get to a position where we're pretty happy with the patient's hemodynamics, and we think that their hemodynamics are roughly in the normal range for them.
Okay.
So, for example, if somebody had a PA catheter in and their cardiac index was quite low, let's say 1.8.
Right.
Right. Okay. I would want to do something to improve the cardiac index to, like, the mid-2s, which is a lot more physiologic for most people. Right?
Right.
Now,
Rick, do you mind if you just can you just say what the normal is for index and output, or like what we would consider normal in our setting?
So in our setting, you know, our patients have cardiac disease, so we're not shooting for the stars.
Yeah.
Nobody's a marathon runner in our unit.
I am.
None of the patients are, I guess. Nobody with swans in.
Yeah, okay.
So I think anything in the mid-2s is, is really perfect.
Okay.
Anything higher is luxury.
Okay.
But if like you can get to the mid-2s, most patients will do fine.
All
right. Once you're in the low-2s or below that, most patients will have a blood pressure, right, with some support. But most of the time, if you leave them in that area for about 1 to 2 days, they'll develop renal failure or an AKI of some sort.
Okay.
Right. So once you leave people in kind of that low of a cardiac output or cardiac index, I should say, for long enough, they'll start to develop an organ dysfunction. Right.
Okay, yeah.
So, I guess what were we talking about? So, like, in a patient, like we were saying, as an example, has an index of 1.8.
Right.
Depending on what we thought the problem was, we might give them fluids to improve the cardiac output.
Mm-hmm.
We might increase the inotropic support to give them cardiac output, like go up on the epi. If their MAP was really, really high already, I might do a different inotrope. I might do Milrinone.
Okay.
Which will give you inotropic support, but will vasodilate you, and so your blood pressure will not go up, it might come down.
Okay, right.
But it'll fix the index. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And so those are the things that we're thinking about, and if anybody has worked with me clinically, they know that I'm, like, semi-obsessed with, like, mixed venous sat.
Yeah, yeah.
And the reason I'm semi-obsessed with it is because it is a one-number indicator of whether your oxygen levels, i.e. your cardiac output,
right,
delivering oxygen, are meeting your tissue demands.
Okay. Yeah.
And for somebody whose mixed venous sat is low, it implies one of two things. One is either your oxygen delivery is inadequate.
Okay.
And for our patients, that's usually the case. Usually what it is that our oxygen delivery is inadequate, meaning for us most of the time, unless they're very hypoxic, it means that the cardiac output's low.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
So you've got plenty of oxygenated blood, you know, when it leaves the lung, but it's not getting it to the tissue.
It just can't reach the area.
Like can't reach the area.
Okay.
And it's not getting through fast enough. The flow is too sluggish.
Okay.
So by the time the blood comes back from the tissue, it's very, very desaturated because the tissue has uptaken as much oxygen as it can and really more than is healthy for it.
Okay.
Right? It's trying, it's working very hard to pull oxygen out of the tissue, out of the blood. so that's one possibility. The other possibility is that your tissue is is using way more blood, way more oxygen than is normal.
Okay.
And so if you were to measure the venous sat of our marathon running co-host in when she was at her moment of greatest stress, so like mile 22, right?
Yeah.
Mile 22, you measure her venous sat, I'm sure it's low.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with her. She's going to be fine. She just needs to stop
for
a minute, and her venous sat will recover. But but that's an example of like why the venous sat might be low, even though the cardiac output is normal or hypernormal, right? So my point is, you know, the reason I obsess over this number a lot clinically is because it's a very good window in my mind into whether we need to do something different for the patient in terms of going up on the inotropy or down on the inotropy. Up on the pressor, down on the pressor.
Okay.
Now, the second part of the question was about pressors.
Right.
So we use pressors just to get an adequate MAP.
Okay.
If your MAP is too low, you just die.
Yeah, sure.
Right? Fair. And we just like, that's totally uncool. So we use pressors to try and get our MAP up. When we really ought to be using them is for people who are vasodilated. And
right.
We see this in our patient population often right after surgery.
Yeah, yeah.
But we also sometimes see it in patients after, you know, if they've been in the unit for a while, they get septic, right? They develop a pneumonia, develop a UTI. We've all seen that.
Yeah, of course.
And then they get sick, and then they vasodilate out.
Right.
Okay? And so in those situations, pressors are very useful. Now, if you use pressors to treat cardiogenic shock, you're in for a bad time because in the long run, that's not going to work.
No good.
But that's the thought process behind something more like norepivasophenylephrine.
Okay. All right. And then, so, I don't know, this is more of my question, and I was trying to do a little bit of looking it up, but, so, vaso, right, we don't titrate vaso typically, because what is a longer, onset and a longer offset or a longer half-life, is that what it is? So is that why with a pressor, vaso, we wouldn't titrate it, but we titrate the levo and then deal with the vaso after the fact, kind of? Not after the fact, but as, bedside nurses, we have a do not titrate order for that one. With the levo, typically we're allowed to play with it up until a certain point.
Right.
So.
That's a good question. So the answer is mostly the answer to the first part of your question is mostly no. So vaso is actually a pretty short-acting onset-offset drug. The reason that it is not open to titration is mostly, I think they're mostly historic.
Okay.
I think that in the past and even now, many people are very nervous about giving vaso because there's a concern about splanchnic vasoconstriction.
Okay.
And some people believe that vasopressin at high doses increases the likelihood of bowel ischemia.
Oh, okay.
So in a way that norepi supposedly does not.
Right.
Now, what I would say is that I don't think that that's totally clear. But that's the reason that you have these do not titrates on vaso. Also, realistically, the drug, right? The functional range of it is pretty narrow.
Right.
You're not going way up on vaso unless the patient really does not look good.
Yeah.
I'm sure you've seen that.
Yeah.
So for those reasons, it's often a do not titrate, especially here in our unit.
Right.
If you go elsewhere, they will allow you to titrate it within reasonable boundaries.
Okay.
And what I would say is that the vaso doses, in my opinion, the vaso doses that are often used clinically are not particularly that high.
Right.
And I don't think that they necessarily dramatically increase your risk of splanchnic vasoconstriction, of bowel ischemia, any more than being really, really sick and needing really high doses of norepi. I think if you're sick enough to need really high doses of pressor, you're at increased risk. That's the reality.
Right. It's gonna do its job one way or another. Yeah.
Right. And you need vasoconstriction one way or the other. And if you need that much vasoconstriction, I can pretty much promise you that there's gonna be some local areas of tissue where the perfusion is wacky.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
All right. I think that's What else? Do you have anything else to add to that question? I don't think I have any other questions.
No, I think it's a good question. I think this is maybe not the best format to address it because it's a big question.
Yeah, and there's a lot of elements to it too. If it were me and I was listening to our podcast right now, I would definitely go look up my normals for cardiac output index, all of your PA gap numbers. Yeah. I would also look up the normals for your mixed venous O2 sat and all of that. So
yeah, and SVR. Now, one last thing on SVR I want to point out is that is a purely calculated number, right? So you measure the cardiac output and you measure the blood pressure, obviously.
Right.
And the SVR is actually just a number that's calculated based off that. There's no way to actually measure the vascular resistance because it's basically trying to figure out the resistance of every little arterial in your body. There's millions of them. So it's impossible. So what we do is we estimate or calculate the SVR based on the measured cardiac output and the measured MAP.
Oh, okay. Okay. Cool. I didn't know that. Awesome.
Okay. Anything else?
No, I think that's it for that question.
Okay. Well, this was fun. Well, maybe we can do it again sometime soon.
Yeah. No, hopefully. And I hope people keep submitting questions because I think there's a lot of them and you can definitely dig into it. So, yeah.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Bye.